I have come here to chew bubblegum and kick ass. And I'm all out of bubblegum.
Whose blood is that? Is that your blood?
Welcome to the Dead Harvey Podcast. This is Brad Paulson. I'm very happy to have back with me today, Aaron Burke. He was on just two episodes ago talking about conspiracy theory movies, and we figured this would be a great segue to bring up a Halloween classic and one of our all-time favorite movies, the 1988 John Carpenter classic, They Live. Aaron, great to have you back. How are you today?
Hey, thanks, Brad. Super stoked to be here. Yeah, we all love our John Carpenter.
And especially 80s John Carpenter, because we were kind of texting last night about like how well this movie held up. And I was like, 80s Carpenter is just fucking awesome. Like there was and I was watching Vampires, and that's kind of where the decline started, although I really dig that movie. James Woods is such a dick in that movie too, but he's funny. Like, he's not likable at all, but he's funny. And Daniel Baldwin is such a thug in it. And it's one of the, like, movie like Vampires is one of those movies that just could not be made anymore. Like, especially with Daniel Baldwin's character. But it was kind of like in that late 90s period. And then when, I'm not sure if that was late 90s or early 90s, but then like when Ghost of Mars came out and all that stuff. And then The Ward, the last Carpenter movie. So it was kind of on the decline. But this to me was like peak awesome Carpenter.
Yeah, well, it's like Schwarzenegger, right?
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Like late 70s, early 80s. Like,
yeah.
Oh, he's going to be doing this for a million years. And then it's like, you know, you're like, Kindergarten Cop. Okay, keep going.
Yeah.
Seventh Day.
Yeah. Eraser. Yeah, I think Eraser was the, what I noticed the start of it for me with the Schwarzenegger decline. Yeah. And then he tried to do like the comeback where he tried to do the dramatic stuff and everything. It didn't really work out. Like there was that movie called Maggie that was, there was super low budget post-apocalypse one about zombies. Yeah. Stay inside. Don't let zombies get to you. Protect yourself. I'll throw you. We will be fine.
And then, with Schwarzenegger. Yeah. It's like Total Recall is your conspiratory. It's like once you do a conspiracy movie, it's all downhill.
Yeah. That's true. Well, that's true. Yeah. The conspiracy movie, he knew too much and then he got cursed. That's what happened.
But also the era's changed too a little bit. It's like music where to do a comparison with like 80s, like hair metal and, you know, and then when it got to grunge, it was kind of like Carpenter, Schwarzenegger, a lot of these type of filmmakers
and
actors had to refine their footing in this more realistic, or at least from what the 80s were. To now, and you know, some, you know, and their classics are in the 80s.
Yeah, absolutely. And this movie was, I mean, Roddy Piper is so fantastic in this movie. He was just, he's so perfectly cast for it.
Yeah.
He's got such a great, like, screen presence and then swagger about him as well, too. It's just, it's so distinct. And what's hilarious, too, is that he's Canadian. You know, he sold himself as like this Scottish. You know, he came out with the bagpipes and everything but he's Canadian, but you can notice like when you hear his accent in the movie, you can see that Canadian come out. And I didn't notice that until, because I was always just thinking Scottish, but because I was always thinking of relating him with the pro wrestling, but you hear the Canadian come out like once you read that, and then I was like, oh, now I'm going to think of him as Canadian instead of Scottish. I have this mug here.
Awesome.
So this is like a mug that I have from the 80s, which is, they used to have the good guys and the bad guys of pro wrestling, and they would switch sides sometimes. But you got Roddy Piper, the Iron Sheik, and then there's this Vladimir, I think it was like Vladimir, I can't remember his last name, but...
That was Ayatollah something or other, yeah.
Yeah. And then you got the good guys, Junkyard Dog, Andre the Giant, and Hulk Hogan. But... John Carpenter was actually a fan of pro wrestling, and that's how he hired Roddy Piper for this. And
funny story about that. So yeah, it was WrestleMania 3.
Yeah.
He's a huge wrestling fan. And then pretty much right after that, he was the opposite. At that stage, pro wrestling, WWF had not admitted, and they hadn't, you know, said that kayfabe was a real thing.
Yeah.
And so for your average, I remember having like intense arguments with my uncle and then my great grandfather, who was in his like 90s at the time. And he's like, wrestling's fake. And then my uncle, whether or not he was messing with him or not, was, no, it's totally real. The referee, you couldn't have referees in there doing that if it wasn't real. And you know, yeah. everyone's in on it, the whole world. And so then John Carpenter, and then shortly after that, they're like, okay, it's not real. And that's when John Carpenter's like, enough of this pro wrestling, I'm out. And that was it. He wasn't a fan after that anymore.
Oh, damn. I did not know.
Yeah. He stopped being a fan once they started to like acknowledge, once Vince McMahon acknowledged that it was like they weren't. Yeah, because you have stories like what's the guy? Kamala, the Ugandan giant, right? He'd be wrestling George the Animal Steele, and they would be like buddies behind the scenes and like staying in like a New York New York hotel. The hotel manager kicks him out because the Kamala beat George the Animal Steele, who was his favorite wrestler. And he's like, you're not allowed here
anymore. Oh, yeah.
Because they thought it was real, like normal, like high school educated people.
Yeah. Yeah. I've heard stories like that too. That's hilarious.
Yeah,
because people get so deeply into pro wrestling, but it's just like his like casting. Well, this is what I heard about why he cast him is that he said he was kind of doing like he had done, I think, like 3 or 4 movies with Kurt Russell in a row at the time.
Yeah.
So he felt like it was a little bit for a change up. And then when he got Roddy Piper is just it's something about like that whole pro wrestling thing that translates great. Like there are certain lines where he talks like a pro wrestler, which is hilarious. So I'm going to bring
for instance, just getting back to your like Canadian accent, he's like,
yeah.
Life's a bitch and she's in heat.
You can hear right. Yeah. Yeah. That's that Canadian part that comes out too. Yeah. You're absolutely right. Yeah. But it's funny too. He'll be acting normal and then he'll just like snap on somebody like Keith David will question him. He'll be like, well, when you get some kind of a master plan, you let me know. And it was great. I was like, oh, he's going into full on pro wrestling insult mode here. But there's just great moments like that in this movie. And him and Keith David make a great pairing. Apparently they go along right away and started hanging out together. I think John Carpenter gave him like a day to just kind of hang out. And then they kind of became friends and they studied that. The famous fight scene in the movie, they rehearsed it for at least 3 weeks.
Yeah.
And John Carpenter liked it so much, he kept the whole thing in. You were telling me about how it kind of rivals the Quiet Man fight scene in terms of like length. So I watched that fight scene the other day, which is great too, just to kind of like to compare them. Yeah. And John Carpenter probably pulled that from the Quiet Man because he's a huge Western fan.
Yeah, they that's kind of what you get. So it's like, you know, with John Carpenter, and let's get into, you know, a little later, those the low budgetness of when, you know,
yeah.
you and I are both low budget filmmakers and made low budget. And when you're doing that, you've got to like squeeze all the resources that you can. He only had $5 million for this movie, which is a damn shame. The guy has created a franchise that's made nearly $1 billion. Yeah. And they can't give this guy $15 million to make a movie. It's ridiculous. And so, you know, and then the movie, it's just like life was like, there's an alternate reality where like John Carpenter's had a James Cameron career, but it didn't happen. But they're both like two of my favorites anyway. But
oh, absolutely. Yeah.
So you cast Roddy Piper, you not only, you're like, okay, this guy's awesome. He's one of the greatest WWE pro wrestling heels of all time. He's a great talker. Kurt Russell had been in like Escape from New York, The Thing, all of just a bunch, you know, so many 4 or 5 movies in a row of John Carpenter. So it's like, I can't do all of them which would be amazing though. You know?
Yeah, you know, definitely. Kurt
Russell, you can't put him in enough movies, but.
Yeah. Oh yeah, absolutely. Yeah. I never get tired of seeing Kurt Russell. Yeah.
Sorry, say again.
They never get tired of seeing Kurt Russell. He's awesome.
No, like, yeah.
So in all stages of his career, he's been great.
Oh, you love him in Mickey Mouse Club most of all.
Well, I like The Barefoot Executive because it's a movie about Kurt Russell with a chimp. And then like the chimp, have you ever seen that movie? It's a Disney classic. Kurt Russell, he's basically like he wants to get into the TV business. So he stumbles across this chimp and the chimp basically picks out TV shows for him. And so he goes to his boss and he's like, these are the TV shows that are going to boost in the ratings. These are the ones to get behind and put all your advertising behind. And the chimp is right on like pretty much almost everything. So it's about how he has to like keep it hidden from the network that a chimp is making all the decisions for him.
Well, it's crazy though. That's actually how it's done. That's the weird thing. That was a, more of an expose movie than anything.
Probably, yeah. So we should probably describe what the plot of They Live
is. Well, real quick, let me button this. Yeah, okay. Real quick. So, you know, what you do when you get a low-budget movie, you only get $5 million. It's like, well, Rowdy Roddy Piper can fight.
Yeah.
So it's like, and then you lean back on a movie like The Quiet Man and you pay homage to it with like, you know, a fight scene just a little bit longer.
Yeah. The funny thing is about the difference between, so in this one, apparently it was just like 5 to 6 pages in the script of They Live is fight continues.
Yeah.
And just blank page to let them rehearse everything. But in The Quiet Man, it's not just them fighting. It's like, but it's much more epic. And like the music and like the music is that way as well too. But it has like these sort of like comical tones that it brings to it to kind of lighten it up. Cause it's like it's not like a brutal fight in The Quiet Man. It's kind of humorous and it stretches out over a long time. And so they'll just go to all these places. Then it'll be cutting between like all of like the toady side characters in town betting on them. And then it would go back to them like kind of like bantering. Then they fight some more. And then it goes back to the town people like following them, getting all excited about it, and like telling all their friends about it. But that kind of goes, but and They Live, it like just stays on these two as they just beat the crap out of each other. Like,
well, they're in an alley. Like so different. There isn't, they're in an alley. It just couldn't be more opposite.
But it was hilarious to watch that Quiet Man scene because that is an awesome scene. I got to go back and see that whole movie again now.
That also makes me why I love, we both have our love of Star Trek, and there's a fight scene in one of the original series.
Yeah.
Of like a Quiet Man length fight scene with Captain Kirk and his old, like he goes to this planet where every dream comes true.
Mm-hmm.
So he got, apparently Kirk or something was like at the academy and like his rival and him got in a fight and maybe lost or something. And then he had this pleasure planet, his cocky cadet rival or whatever challenges him to a fight. And so you got Captain Kirk and stuntmen like
falling
out of trees and choking each other.
Yeah.
Fist head button and fist fighting for like literally a whole act of a Star Trek.
Damn. Send me that. Send me which episode that is. I'll check that out.
Oh, it's hilarious. So it's right out of that Quiet Man, They Live. But it's like, it's funny because you don't get martial scenes in a Western sense.
Yeah,
you get
a
lot of that coming from China and, you know, Japan, karate, kung fu, all this different stuff, which is the norm. But in American cinema, bare knuckle, like just, you know, aside from boxing ring, it's awesome. We need more of it.
Yeah, well, absolutely. And then, that's what this fight in They Live was like The Quiet Man and They Live. It's like some of it is looks like it's brutal. Like when they're, I don't know how they're hitting the ground and not hurting themselves.
Well, they're taking pain. I also,
Well, they're landing on asphalt that does not look like it's fake. It looks like they're landing on real asphalt.
They didn't have the money for fake asphalt.
Yeah.
I think like Roadhouse is like a rare exception to where it's like a world where fist fighting like matters.
Yeah.
We're all about the gun out here, but fist fighting matters in Roadhouse.
Yeah. Be nice until being nice is no longer an option or something similar.
Hey, I'm on my break.
So They Live is about an alien invasion that is basically Roddy Piper. He puts on these sunglasses and he can see the world as it really is. Aliens living among us, aliens. And then the funny thing about the alien design is that they have real weird, like they look like low budget, like 50s movie, aliens in the face. But the whole reason for that I read was because aliens are corrupting humanity. So their face is corrupted. So they're kind of zombie like in that. Weird. But the only way that you can see these aliens is with glasses. And Roddy Piper is a drifter that stumbles across these glasses. And then he tries to bring Keith David, his sidekick at the construction place, to join him and fight against these creatures, against this alien invasion. But it is, talk about a movie that's way, way ahead of its time.
Well, it's crazy. So it's based off one of the world's shortest stories called Eight in the Morning by Ray Nelson. I read it the other day in preparation.
Oh, nice.
It's written as if the guy is late for work. Mm-hmm. It's so like the short story starts with him being hypnotized. Like he's like, and then the hypnotist said, literally the first line is, and the hypnotist said, awaken. Yeah. And then he's like, just, he's like, oh, there's a sea of faces out there and half of them are fucking aliens. And yeah, literally it starts like that. So think about the moment where he puts the glass, Roddy puts the, or Nada puts the glasses mm-hmm. on in They Live. It's like at midpoint or for end of, for it's way into the movie.
Yeah.
So that was when John Carpenter was like, okay, this, there's something there. So anyway, to button the 8 o'clock in the morning. So the guy gets a message or wakes up from his hypnotism. He sees who are aliens and who aren't. Some like, so then he goes outside of the theater where the magician was doing this trick mm-hmm. and then like murders a bum, goes home to his girlfriend. The neighbor stops by, he cuts his throat, goes in and kills his wife. I mean, guy goes on a fucking murder spree with his like 6 pages long. He kills like 12 people.
Wow.
Just killing people. Anybody that like looked tentacly and weird, he just didn't even give a shit and sliced their throat. But you get sleep 8 hours a day, work 8 hours a day, play 8 hours a day, obey all of the, you know, I mean, Carpenter, you know, expanded upon it, but he could like see the messages, stay asleep, all of the things that were beyond and beneath the subliminal stuff. Anyway, so yeah. And then at the end of the day, he ends up breaking into his TV studio. Like he's on the run. He's just killing anybody that's an alien and without like unprovoked to the, they're not attacking him or anything. He just like, and I stabbed him in the forehead and he died and he turned his bum. Like he smashed the brick on a bum's head.
No, was there, I heard that there was like a timeline in that too. Like he has to solve, like he has to stop the alien invasion by 8 a.m.
He gets a call randomly from the chief of police. So somehow he knows this person. They don't have the runway to get into it. And he's like, you will die, you know, in at eight in the morning, you will have a heart, your heart will stop is what he said. He's like, well, I've got, that's not true. I'm fine, but I might as well go out with a bang. And so he breaks into it, all this. He's just indiscriminately killing anybody that's an alien. He ties his girlfriend up. No one else can see it. Of course, that's the weird thing, only through his eyes. So it's his ultimate paranoid delusion. Is this real? Is this guy like had a break from reality? Because no one sees it but him.
And so reminds me of Frailty, kind of a little bit. Yeah.
Of course, you ain't a demon, is you?
Yeah.
And so then on the radio, they're like, their APBs are looking for him or whatever. So anyway, he makes his way. He's like, okay, well, I've got to like, I'm going to die at 8 a.m. I've got to expose this. So he breaks into a TV station and just machine guns whoever's like an alien in his way, kills the anchor who turns into an alien. And then off, while the cameras are rolling on the alien off screen, he's like, we are your masters. Wake up to the, you're being invaded. And then he goes home and he doesn't wake up. He dies of a heart attack at 8 a.m.
Oh, crazy.
Yeah.
Crazy. Yeah, that's interesting. But there are quite a few parallels they took from it, from just that like that short story. And there was an Eclipse comic that came out from it as well too. I haven't read that one.
Same,
I
gotta check that one out
now. Yeah. Oh, nice. That's cool.
Yeah, Ray Nelson also did the comic book, or at least wrote it. Again, super short. But the crazy thing about reading it is it's almost as if, because this was written for like Amazing Tales or Weird and Wild, whatever those pulp magazines or cartoon strips were back in the day. And it's like, it felt like he spent an hour on it. Like he was like, oh God, oh, I'll be right there, honey. No, I will. Yeah. No, I will pack the car. And it like, it begins.
Yeah.
You get as late as it can get in and it ends instantly. There's no anything else. But what's crazy is it's probably the least amount of work. I guarantee you that was like 2 hours of writing. There was not like, oh, he just had a thought. He threw it down. And then to like have John Carpenter, so he's credited as the story. So basically, the story by credit or based on a story. So when They Live begins, it's based on a story called 8 o'clock in the morning by Ray Nelson.
Yeah.
So it's just awesome amount of work you get, and like to have like a nod from John Carpenter.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. Sometimes like the least amount of work pays off the most. That's like funny.
Well, how did they find question? How did they find it?
Like, I don't know. Yeah, I didn't see anything in like the stuff that I read about where they discovered how they found it. It may have been from the comic. Maybe he read the comic and then went to the short story after that. But
I bet he had a team of people, because it's like, not to get too off topic, but it's like, so like Ridley Scott, he's not coming up with these ideas.
Yeah.
He's doing Philip K. Dick or, you know, other, you know, like, how do you know where to find this stuff? And that was with John Carpenter too. He's like, somebody was like, you got to make this or something.
What's funny is that Carpenter used a pseudonym. He used a pseudonym as Frank Armitage for the screenplay credit, because he was like, well, all these, this is funny because the stuff I was reading where he was saying, my name's just all over everything. It's like, it's always like John Carpenter's Christine or John Carpenter's the thing. He's like, and I just felt like it was a little bit too much of an ego thing. I was writing, producing, and directing, and then it says John Carpenter's. I was like, well, I mean, you may as well have the screenplay credit too then. I don't know why that's the one thing that he decided not to to change. I thought that was kind of interesting.
And that's, you know, and that's a nod to H.P. Lovecraft.
That's so, right. Was it like a detective character from H.P. Lovecraft?
He was a librarian in the Dunwich Horror.
Oh, okay.
Crazy-ass Lovecraft story.
Dunwich Horror, yeah, yeah.
Yeah, so the guy's like, he's just a librarian, and then the half-brother of this monster, this like Cthulhu-type monster or whatever, like old Sumerian god or whatever, like has mates with a human woman, and then there's two brothers, and one's like only half like awful and the other one's fully like monstrous. Half brother dies in the library. It's random as hell, and then the librarian takes up the mantle to figure out like what's causing all this, like cows are going missing and like people are getting eaten and stuff. And then he goes, but again, this one and They Live have these like kind of out of nowhere optimistic endings.
Yeah, that's true. And Roddy Piper's character in this movie is very optimistic too, which is bizarre. I noticed something about this after, because I went back and watched it a couple of times, because this movie is just, it's got great replay value. Mm-hmm. It's like 93 minutes. It moves fast. The whole thing is like very, it's just very fun. The whole movie is very fun.
Yeah.
But one thing I noticed is that Roddy Piper is not the reluctant hero. Keith David is the reluctant hero.
Yeah.
Because Roddy Piper is optimistic about everything. He's like, he's homeless, basically, but he's optimistic. He's like, I believe in America. I just want to do a hard day's work for a decent pay. And that's it. And
then, thicker Canadian accent. I'll do
a hard day's work. Yeah. I just wanted like for, you know, a hard day's work for a decent pay, eh? I mean, that's it, eh? But Keith David's like, no, everything that Keith David says from the beginning is like, we're getting screwed over. Like the regular man is getting screwed over. And Roddy Piper's like, you should be like a little bit more optimistic about life. And Keith David's like, I'm all out of that.
Yeah.
He's like, we're getting screwed over and everything. So Keith David literally has to be dragged kicking and screaming and beaten to have the glasses put on his face to see, to wake up, basically. Yeah. But I thought it was kind of interesting how they did sort of the reversal of it, because usually the main character is the reluctant hero, but this was Keith David in this part. Roddy Piper just throws himself into it. He's like, I got nothing to lose. I'm going to kill
Aloy. It's weird because he did that the whole way, like the whole Meg Foster, like he's like an idiot. Like,
yeah,
clearly. I mean, she looks like a damn alien already.
Yeah, it's true. She does.
The Holly character or whatever. So
I mean, hot alien, but yeah, definitely. Yeah, looking in. Yeah.
Absolutely. She's definitely hot, but it's like, yeah, it's so strange. You're right to point that out again, where it's like, so he's the optimistic, like more, you know, Pollyannish, like there's nothing going on. Yet he's the one that finds the conspiracy. David Keith is like, you know,
he's pissed off and bitter, and he's not
bitter, but doesn't believe in the conspiracy.
Yeah. And he just wants to be left alone. Yeah.
There's a whole bunch of little odd, like counterintuitive things in this movie we can get to down the road a little bit, but it's like, that's certainly one of them. And it's like, so he just runs headlong. So there's this naivety to Nada in the whole, going through the whole thing, you pointed out. And especially with the girl, like this chick is like, she cracks him in the head with a bottle and throws him out a two-story fucking window, yeah, which he then rolls to another 2 minutes down a hill.
Yeah.
And then he sees her again and he's like, holy, good to see you. Like, not even like, not even, she didn't even think she apologizes.
No, barely. Yeah. She's like, oh, he goes, oh, I got to go talk to her. And then he goes to talk to her. And then she goes, oh, I thought I had killed you. He's like, yeah. Yeah, I thought you had killed me too for a moment there. What's going on? But how's it going?
Oh. Yeah. No, he's all about it. Like, out of nowhere, like, he has no spidey sense. Usually, it's just, there's just things that, choices that were made, like, with this character that are so different than normal action movies that the character would do. Like, you know, even, like, some of the Arnold characters, you know, are a little suspicious of, like, look at Total Recall again, you know. It's like, he's got, you know, the Sharon Stone is full of paranoia.
Mm-hmm.
He just dives right in with this girl and has no, like,
no
second guessing at all.
Yeah.
Considered it the divorce.
Oh, it's great. Yeah, but he, like, it's funny too, because he, it seems like he just wants to get paid and then be fine, and like he would turn a blind eye to everything, but he goes out of his way as soon as he sees stuff going on with the people that he's working with, going in and outside of this place, it's like an old church or something, and people going out and in and out of this place like late hours. He's like, oh, let me just gonna break in there and find out what's going on. And he starts smashing through walls and like looking for stuff, and until he uncovers the conspiracy right by itself. Then he goes to Keith David, who you think would be inciting this, and be like, look, man, don't tell me that. I don't want to know about it. Just leave me alone.
Yeah. We, and then it's like, even later, it's like, you know, there's a great line, probably, I mean, second to Chew Bubblegum and Kick Ass, which is like, it's like, I lived my whole life going down that white line. And then Rowdy's like, the white line is in the middle of the road. But it's like, yet, it's just, I think that there's a certain, like, I can appreciate the low budget quality of it, but it's like there's so many contradictions in it. Like, just like that, we talked about how the characters, one's reluctant, the other one, but yet Keith David's claiming he lives in the middle of the road, and Rowdy Piper warns him that's where you get run over.
Yeah.
But I think some of this, and I'll even go into like my critique a little bit of like the makeup and all that. Like, I think this movie could have been because it's a cult movie. There's no way around that. It's like half the people never even heard of Damn They Live. But had it had a little more budget, had they had a little more time to really plumb some of these ideas, I think some of this is, you know, I love John Carpenter, but it's like the low budgetness has its positives and it has its negatives. It's all amazing. I mean, like the you know, the alien makeup is some of the worst makeup I have ever seen in a movie ever, and it adds to the charm, I suppose, but because we love Carpenter and he's cool, it just gets a pass. It's like, if they had a little more money, I mean, it is just god, oh man.
Yeah, what I thought they were trying to do from that, it was some sort of like an ode to kind of 50s sci-fi movies, sort of cheesier looking, but it makes sense that they would have like the aliens corrupting humans, but I guess I would be thinking more kind of like a zombie alien, as opposed to like kind of what they showed. But yeah, what they showed was definitely more cheesy, kind of like Mars Attacks, like sort of aliens in the face a little bit. Without the big heads. Yeah,
Mars Attacks is the worst. That's like the worst aliens ever.
But that was all. But Mars Attacks was also like super intentional cheese. So that's what they were going for. This was something where in the middle, where it kind of has a little bit of an Uncanny Valley look. I know what you're saying about that. Yeah.
Yeah, but I mean, I think that's just kind of, again, it's just what you get out of it. I would be very curious to see. I promise you, if you had another $10 million, that would have gotten them. It was one of the first things to get. Like,
Are you talking about like, saying the movie had a much better effect if the aliens were all gnarly and creepy looking, as opposed to
it looks fake.
And that's why I think that it's that 50s ode to it, but I'm not sure. But
yeah, I mean, I just think he gets I think that you're not wrong. There's just a certain, I think it just comes from the low budget quality of it. It's like the certain things are like, don't think about certain things too much. Like okay, like Reproduce and Marry, right?
Yeah.
That's not a bad one. That's a good one. Like, is that supposed to be keeping humanity going? But is there a parasite? I mean, there is. So they're doing that so that they can just like live parasitically on top of us then? Like, you know, like a farmer.
I guess like reproduce. So like use this, keep like the steady flow of livestock in for them until they can deplete the resources on our planet and then move on to another one. Because that the newscaster guy was kind of talking about that. I think that part meant to be just reproduce so that we can keep using you as a food source or as a source to take over as our own resource, basically.
Well, I guess that's good. I mean, like, it's kind of like the Federal Reserve in another conspiracy on a side note is like, why you can have kids and then those kids get to be taxed and you can just tax them their whole life. You know, whatever they make, the government's going to get a third of anything that you make. And if you make more, they're going to get a half of it. So I guess in that way, you know, I guess I could understand why that's a part of the theme.
I think that was maybe too, they were going for something because it was kind of about individualism. So maybe against going against the grain, like don't try and think of like not doing what everybody else is doing, alluding to that a little bit as well, too, because it was like no independent thought. Yeah. Do not question authority. Just do what you're told, basically.
Just look like, over your shoulder if you need to figure out any of the sayings. They're right there.
Yeah, that's true. Yeah. Yeah. I have a background with all the signs that he sees. And I'd read some stuff about like how they were saying that Carpenter saying that was the trickiest part, all the subliminal messaging, because they had to literally go and they had to build like inside of the warehouses. They had to build everything that had all the individual signs. Yeah. So they could do it now a lot easier with all the CGI, but then in 88, they had to like design everything for it.
Yeah.
He said that was one of the most expensive and most time consuming parts. Yeah.
Yeah. The convenience store. You
that was great.
Okay. You real ugly.
Yeah. That's the convenience store. That's great. When he said like formaldehyde face, I just busted up laughing. It's hilarious. Oh,
that's so good.
And the line, I have come here, no one could do it as great as Roddy Piper, or
Ted for that.
Ted could do that very well. But the way that he delivers it is so great.
I'm here to chew bubblegum and
I've come here
out of bubblegum.
To chew bubblegum and kick ass, and I'm all out of bubblegum. So why would he? I mean, it sounds a lot cooler when he says that, but if he already tells people that he's out of bubblegum, why would he mention that he's here to kick ass and chew bubblegum if he's already said that he doesn't have any more bubblegum?
Yeah,
because it sounds much more cool to say that you already had all the bubblegum, I guess, or just to put that. Because I've come here to kick ass. Then people be like, it's moderately intimidating, I guess, but it doesn't sound very cool.
Well, I think that that's a nice example. It's an allegory. Yeah. That example right there kind of encapsulates all of They Live. Don't dig too deep on this.
Yeah.
On the surface level, this thing is cool as hell.
Exactly.
You're amazing, but don't like, well, wait a minute, it's here. Chew bubble gum, and why doesn't he just say it like that? That doesn't make any sense at all.
It's because he had all these, he had a notebook full of pro wrestling lines that he used for insults. John Carpenter picked that as one of his favorite ones.
Yeah.
But yeah, that one was definitely all Roddy Piper. That was his line all the way.
He's a mouth. He's one of the best. He's absolutely one of the best around. There's no doubt about that. It's like this movie too is like, you know, so just doing a little research on it, you know, and just listening to some Carpenter interviews, it's like, he was like kind of roughly based this on like, or not roughly directly based this off like the Reagan era of like,
he comes flat out and says that like this movie is about yuppies and the Reagan era of ultra consumerism. He goes, and he said that he's like, every time I'm like watching TV or looking at a magazine, they're always trying to sell me something. And right. So that's kind of what that came from. Yeah. But there, but I was gonna say there's been different interpretations of it, but Carpenter's like, no, it was about, ultra consumerism and about the yuppies and that time period, that Reaganomics. So he, like a lot of directors, like David Lynch or other people like that, they will say, like Lynch will say, I want the audience to interpret what it is. He won't tell people what right. the meaning is. That's why people are still scratching their heads thinking about what's going on in his movies. But yeah. Carpenter will just usually flat out say it. This is what I was trying to say in this movie.
Well, but again, the crazy thing is, it's like, yeah, I get it. He's an idealistic hippie. He certainly fucking looks like a hippie. Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
You know, and it's his movies are ultra violent and like awesome. So it's that's a strange kind of like, you know,
like an old school like Cameron hippie when Cameron was on the beach, like having visions about killer robots and stuff. Yeah. He was probably old school hippie too, I think, Cameron.
Yeah. Yeah. Another movie based on a short story in the Outer Limits and all that. But anyway, but he can say that. That's fine. Reagan consumerism and all that. But it's like this movie's like a Rorschach test for conspiracy theories. You can kind of plug in anyone that you want. He's not that overtly. Yes, it's a morning in America. There's a couple of things, but that's the why we're still talking about They Live.
Yeah, absolutely. Well, it's because it's with like especially like the last couple of years. Well, I would say like ever since 9/11, since what it started happening with the Patriot Act and after that. This and like all the Big Brother kind of stuff too, especially with social media and the NSA surveillance on people and how Snowden had to flee because of that. And then the CIA lied about the NSA lied about their surveillance on people, all that kind of this like really like is a precursor to all that stuff with 1984 put in. So it can apply on a variety of different levels. It's a sort of like almost like a Nostradamus kind of view into the future.
Yeah, it really is. And I think one of its strengths is that it was made before the internet.
Yeah, absolutely. Absolutely. Yeah.
Before, like, you know, essentially it was like a kind of like an analog world that we lived in a way. And up until about the early 90s or whatever. And then it just started to really change quite a bit, just regular people's lives. It's interesting because it's like the rebels hang out at a church. I think there's something there to that. You know, there's a preacher and a church and like, you know, if you're digging into, because you could have had that anywhere. So I don't know what he's saying. Maybe organized religion is okay, but there are, you know, other people that would say organized religion is the same as obey, reproduce and marry. Right. It's interesting. Again, the movie's just a bunch of contradictions to me. Once you start analyzing on a deeper level, but I can tell you now, if the movie was made like you, this isn't a movie you could ever make again.
No, not at all. Just like even the scene where Roddy Piper comes in and says, I have come here to chew bubblegum and kick ass. When he just starts, because there's like a bunch of random civilians in there with the aliens. Just a scene like where you go into a public place and start shooting it up. Right. They would instantly change all that now. Like even if you're like shooting the aliens, any kind of like public shooting kind of stuff is going to be taken out. I remember the Punisher series was delayed like 2 or 3 months, maybe even more after that Vegas shooting because the times are just so different now. Like these, the 80s movies where it's like just like the mowing everything down with a machine gun like Arnold did, like the heyday of the 80s and stuff. They're so much more careful about that now. So you just can't have these.
No
movies nowadays, because the 80s and stuff used to be where you kind of like you're saying, like where you don't think too much, it's just like a lot of fun.
Yeah.
But so anything remade nowadays, like Roadhouse, is going to have a more serious version of it, or there's going to be social things going on in it, and people will be scratching their head going, is this the
having
same
sex movie on your break in the bathroom? Yeah. Did she say that was okay? He's got her like up on a couple of cardboard boxes banging her in the closet.
Like, yeah,
that scene
yeah.
ain't gonna make it in, bro.
No, yeah, so mm-hmm. many things to like. That's why, like, a lot of these 80s movie stuff are just in a time capsule where it's like enjoy it where it's at, because everything is so serious now that you're not gonna be able to have the fun like you used to anymore. That's why a lot of those 80s movies are kind of like peak awesomeness. Yeah. The action movie, like with Predator and stuff like that, and Commando, it like when we were kids and we were watching that, we thought it would just get better, but. That was pretty much as awesome. At least up until now, that's as good as it gets. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, so if it was today, one of the differences in They Live would be that shit's taking, that conspiracy's all happening on front of a computer. Mm-hmm. That's happening online. Like it's the big difference is conspiracy and the Banshee chapter
are
so like wildly different than because of the internet.
Mm-hmm. Yeah,
you know, absolutely. Now you're getting it. It's like, oh, it's a church, and it's, oh, it's not a real church. They're broadcasting these messages, and the glasses are what wake you up. Not, you know, hypnotism, you know, because he thought the hypnotism was too cheesy.
Yeah.
From the original short story, 8 a.m. Yeah. So he's like, well, and that's an awesome, just a great Carpenter-esque ad. It's like cool sunglasses that you can see through.
You know? Yeah. And I'd also heard that those sunglasses were from Big Trouble in Little China. So there was a huge supply of the glasses that Kurt Russell had. They decided to just use, because it was more of like trying to save budget. They had all these like leftover props of these glasses from Big Trouble in Little China, so they just ended up using them for Roddy's Piper's glasses for They Live, which I thought was kind of funny.
But again, that's the low budget beauty of Carpenter, which is like, he's the most famous low budget director. I mean,
oh yeah,
Rodriguez is easily dealing with big budgets. It's unbelievable that at that stage in his career, he's getting $5 million. It's all Kevin Smith gets $5 million.
Yeah. And I think that's why Carpenter just plays music now. It's like, you want to remake my stuff? Go ahead. Just give me money. And then I'll just like play in my band for people. Cause he like tours with his sons, and they go like play just like all of his like synth instrumental music from his movies at concerts. Wow. And I mean, that would be really fun to see that in concert. Carpenter play like all the hits.
Definitely. I forgot to tell you, or I need to tell you. So I've met Rowdy Roddy Piper before.
Oh, nice.
Yeah. And
when was this?
He was as cool. This is 2011. This is quite a while back. Yeah. Obviously, you know, he passed in 2015, but maybe a couple years before that, for whatever reason, one of my buddies is a red carpet reporter. So I was like, the movie called the Machine Gun Preacher. With
the Gerard Butler one,
yeah. And apparently, he was friends with Rowdy for whatever reason. Rowdy was there on the carpet, and you know, it wasn't in Hollywood, it was it was like Glendale or Pasadena, it was out of like the main Hollywood area, you know, where you'd think you'd get these red carpets. And Rowdy was hanging out. I'm obviously a huge, you know, wrestling fan and love They Live, and you know, I went up and I was just introduced. I think it was on the carpet. So we were getting a bunch of pictures taken of us and stuff. And he was just doing photos with people and stuff. But we sat and chatted for like 5 minutes. And I was like, listen, I love, you know, Hell Comes to Frogtown. That's like, I have a real soft spot for that one. He's like, oh, let me tell you, when my wife found out the plot of that one, she wasn't happy with me one little bit.
I mean, like that he has to, that he's the last man on Earth and he has to repopulate the planet.
Being the last fertile man on Earth.
Yeah.
He didn't like that one little bit. It was like such a cool moment. And he chilled, you know, I was like, you know, I think he was just happy that someone knew some of the movies he was in. But I was like, we had a nice, nice chat. And he's such a fun, just such an, I mean, the world is a lesser place. He died way too soon. It's just
way too soon. He's only like 61, I think, when he passed away in 2015. Right. It's crazy. Yeah. But he was just awesome. I mean, and this movie, it's like, so I watched it a couple more times, and this movie is a favorite of mine. But each time you watch it, you're just like, you realize Carpenter knew right away that he would be perfect for this part, and he really isn't. And he's got more range than a lot of pro wrestlers, because when he's in the scene just reacting to people, he's very focused on it. He's in the moment the entire time. He's not like a monotone delivery kind of pro wrestler or just say your lines. He's really into the movie the whole way. And Carpenter said that when he saw him, he could tell life experience. He's like, I can tell this guy's got internal scars. He's been through shit. And I was reading a little bit about Piper's past, and he was kind of homeless for a while, drifting between different encampments when he was younger. So yeah, he's been through a lot of shit, but it tells in the movie. But he's also got kind of like a really sort of personal side to himself, or kind of a real like just like a real down to earth side that anybody could connect with, especially like the whole like blue collar worker that he's portraying in there. He's got a very relatable personality, as well as like likability and swagger too, which is great.
Well, and that's the theme I think we're pounding here is like, when you're doing these low budget movies, you've got to take advantage of what the cards that are dealt to you.
Yeah.
So he was a Nana was a different character. So from the comic book or the short, then the comic book's like five, you know, 7 pages long anyway. So it's nothing like there's no real depth of source material here. And the Nana literally has no, he's a guy that sees aliens because he was hypnotized or woken up. Mm-hmm. And he beats them with bricks. That's the character. There is nothing else. And so when, you know, when Carpenter got Piper to, you know, wanted to do it, he was like, I'm just going to take this. Cause so yeah, he's born up in Moose Knuckles, Saskatchewan or something like that. And, you know, like, I think he was grew up in an orphanage or like single parent home or broken, was like emancipated in like, you know, 15 or 16 or whatever, I don't know, whatever. But those traveling and doing working jobs and just kind of like figuring it out, that's all like that determined, like the, it was the essentially the spine, not the spine, but the meat and bones on top of a very, you know, limited spine of a guy that wakes up, sees aliens, and at the end he kills a few people that are alien, and then wakes up the world at a TV station. Those, that's all. Mm-hmm. Everything else was the Roddy Piper, like, blue collar, and it shaped the whole story.
Yeah, yeah, absolutely. And it's cool, like, even the beginning, like, when he's walking by, this is what I was reading about it, too, when he's walking by the train tracks, they did the music, like, when they were coming up with the music for it, they were sort of syncing it to his footsteps. Mm-hmm. So it's like, and then it's got that little bit of a twang in there. So many of his movies have like on that score, because he does the score for most or not all of his movies.
Yeah, his partner. Yeah.
It's always the music is always has some sort of like a Western movie influence to it. Like that twang in the background that you hear, like that slow kind of staccato, but like matching with his footsteps, but also like very catchy. That's John Carpenter is so minimalist. Effectively minimalist in so many ways, which is great for indie filmmakers to study, because the music is minimalist but super catchy, like, you know, the score to Halloween or the score to Christine. Everything else is super, super catchy but very basic, like the theme to Jaws, and he repeats that consistently. And then, like, usually his production value is sort of minimalistic, and what he focuses on, these movies are usually shorter or not bloated like other filmmakers, but everything is just so minimalist in a way that works really well. But like you're saying, sometimes there's pros and cons of that as well too. But
well, you hit on something too, which is like, you know, so, you know, John, aside, obviously Halloween, you know, John Carpenter's not the most commercially successful director, but it's like, you know, the movies that were successful from his aren't ones that stand the test of time, and the ones that weren't successful are like massive cult, like
that become like the great cult movie, like The Thing, and
Thing, Big Trouble, Little China. These are like monster movies that just made no damn money at all. They Live didn't do much either. I mean, it's a little better, but not.
I think it opened number one for the first 2 weeks, and then it kind of slumped after that for all. Yeah. But yeah, a lot of these movies have become. Yeah, you're right. Especially The Thing. The Thing was really. Was really looked down upon when it came out, and it was called they referred to it as gore porn. It almost got an X rating. And now it's like this classic that everyone reveres, especially for the makeup and everything else. But yeah, it's bizarre, like the amount of time that will be between something that's banned and then a classic, or something that's looked down upon by critics as something terrible, and then like has a huge cult audience and everybody loves it so many years later. But
well, it's like artists, you know, in general, like a Van Gogh or something, you know, you're not going to get appreciated in your lifetime. Usually in cinema, you're gonna, if you're any good. This is an odd kind. Like I said, there's a lot of contradictions and like things about it, but it's also like his legacy is so massive where it's like this guy's influence is on everything. That's the thing. So again, it may not be him. I mean, look, They Live is great. And The Thing is one of my favorite movies of all time, but his shadow is so long. Not just in like, you know, being a director or whatever, but like his musical, like,
yeah,
I love his stuff. It's like, look at Stranger Things, the whole synth thing. I mean, you know, I'm sure no one does it in a vacuum by themselves, but like Carpenter's like, I love, like, forget his score. I mean, like Halloween's obviously super iconic, but I just listen to like random Carpenter jam sessions with like,
yeah, I do too. Like if you're writing or anything like that, Put his music on. It's super inspiring. It's great.
Like, they had better given him a nod from Stranger Things, because that's like the synth wave or whatever it's called. Is like, that is 1,000% Carpenter.
Yeah, absolutely. You notice, like, and this is what I noticed in Stranger Things, the font at the beginning of Stranger Things is like the font in the Stephen King books from the 80s. And Carpenter collaborated with King a lot. So you have that synth music there. It's the marriage of Carpenter and King, just even in that intro alone for Stranger Things.
100%.
And the 80s influence, and the influence it had from the 80s to now.
Well, it's an 80s font, isn't they?
Yeah. Like an 80s. Well, is that one that it was on all like the old school King books?
Yeah.
On the old school Stephen King books.
Okay.
But it's very distinct, like late 70s to 80s font on there. But yeah, but his influence is mostly in the 80s, because that's when Carrie and Christine and Pet Sematary and all that stuff came out. So yeah, that's what
I really feel like Christine should. He didn't love Christine. I mean, to even get into that, but it was like, I have a soft spot.
Oh, Christine is one of my favorites.
Yeah,
mine's amazing. Amazing.
He didn't like it?
Really? That's weird.
Well, he was like, so this was a movie he felt he had to make rather than he needed to make the thing. That was like, okay, aliens are bad. I want to do just like They Live. Those are the ones he wanted to make. Christine. What was it? Not Scanners, but what's the other one that he did during that time? It was Starman. So it's
which is very different from all the rest of his movies. Yeah,
yeah, that's when. So he does these ones, like he'll have like every third project is one that's like he's got to like, you know, cement the swimming pool or you know pay
for
a house or something.
I think that was the goal with Memoirs of an Invisible Man too, the Chevy Chase one. He tried to do a comedy and it didn't work. So then he had to be shit. Cause he said in a lot of interviews that he always wanted to do Western. So that's why there's all the Western influence.
Right.
I don't know if they wouldn't let him do a Western at the time, cause it wasn't commercial. It was too much of a commercial risk, I guess. In the 80s, you barely saw any Westerns coming out, but I think that's partly like him wanting to do other movies. But clearly, horror is what he's really good at. So it's like, that's what it's always going to go back to. Like, guys like Wes Craven and so many other directors have tried different things as well, too. But they always get pulled back to what they're internally really good at and what's in their blood. Like, whether they want it to be or not, it's in their blood and they're great at it.
Oh, he'd love to make sci-fi movies, but you're just too damn good at making horror movies, so...
Yeah, exactly. I think Christine is excellent. I'm surprised he didn't like that one very much. Well, but it's weird because like King hates The Shining. Like Stephen King hates the movie version of The Shining, but I think I actually like the movie version of The Shining better than the book. It's probably the only movie version of his that I've liked better than the book.
Well, and that's Kubrick too. You know, it's like, again, it's like, so one of my, you know, if I have a critique on They Live is that this was a rushed movie. There wasn't money for it. I mean, maybe if they would have had a look, and I'm not going to take anything away from Hot Rod, but if Kurt Russell was in it, probably would have gotten $15 million. You know what I mean? They would have, no way Kurt Russell's going to be in a $5 million movie. It wouldn't even make any sense. Like, how much does it cost to put Kurt Russell? $5 million at least? That's the whole budget. So you probably got Roddy Piper for, you know, $200,000, $300,000, you know, just for the meat and potato, the logistics of it all.
Yeah.
So it's like he made a decision and this is the path I'm going down. And if Kurt Russell was in that, this movie would have had three times the budget, no doubt. It couldn't do it otherwise.
Yeah, this movie sort of plays like a one-off from the rest of Carpenter movies. Because, normally you will see Kurt Russell. Every now and then he'll shift to different actors. But quite a few of his movies have had Kurt Russell and been like very successful as well, too. But I guess not until later, because that was the same thing, Big Trouble in Little China and The Thing. But Kurt Russell is definitely the most memorable. But I think Roddy Piper is awesome. And I also really like Keith David is great in this movie. So Keith David, John Carpenter pulled from The Thing because Keith David made a good impression on him when he was in The Thing. So he's in this now. And I mean, just like Keith David's voice alone as the voice of Spawn.
How do you get the beans above the Franks?
The comedy stuff he's been in. He's a great actor, and he's got one of the most perfect voices for voiceover, anything like comic book characters or anything. I think he would have been great to play Spawn in real life as well too. Although I think Michael Jai White did a great job, but
he did the voice of Spawn, right?
He did the voice of Spawn in the HBO animated series, yeah,
which is fun.
Yeah, but he's always solid. Keith David's always great. And like, he's, I don't know if he has any kind of pro wrestling background or anything, but that scene that they worked out for 3 weeks definitely was effective and it was awesome.
Yeah, he was a boxer and a dancer, basically. So he didn't really do any of that kind of stuff. Another thing we have to say before we move any further or whatever is, you know, we talked about David Icke in the last.
Yeah.
You know, with the two other movies we did the last time. And it's like, so David Icke was, a soccer goalie. And now, you know, is probably one of the most famous conspiracy theorists that, shape-shifting reptilians are, the elite through the, England, or sorry, the Crown's bloodline and all of the, elite that run the world are all have been like shape-shifting reptilians and all of that stuff. And David Icke didn't come upon that. So basically, David Icke got like a reading by like a psychic, and it's like, your life's going to change. You're going to be getting these visions from God in the next couple of years. Be ready and be awake for it. And that happened in like 92, 93. Mm-hmm. So the final in the series, which is definitely a sister concept to They Live. Then you have They Live that comes out. And I wonder how much of that these movies influenced all of that, because it's pretty like
exactly
just the reach of Carpenter.
It definitely it had to have made its way into his brain. Absolutely. 100%. especially if you're into sci-fi. Those kind of like that whole like I love that whole reptilian theory, but that's a whole other episode could be like David Icke themed movies, which would be quite a bit.
Reptilians in cinema. I mean,
reptilians in cinema. Yeah.
But again, look at like its influence on a movie. You don't think for a minute the Wachowski brothers are not familiar with They Live.
Well, and then the South Park Cripple Fight was based off of They Live as well too. And I think they had it like almost as long. I think they might have matched like the time length on it when Timmy was in the Cripple Fight on that one. Yeah, but there's been a huge influence of They Live on other movies. Also, Roddy Piper did a little bit of a comeback when he was in It's Always Sunny in Philadelphia for I think like a year or two before he passed. He was in that.
Well, he paved the way for like. He was the first pro wrestling movie star.
Yeah.
Look at The Rock and all that. It's just funny because when The Machine, and I think it's the era. So it's like, you know, you can do these low budget movies. If Carpenter and Piper were doing movies today, they are going to be plugged into a machine.
Like yeah.
They're not going to like, Rock's not just going to do one movie and then not do anymore. You know, it's just weird. And so it's like, I think that whatever, and that's a discussion for another day, but it's like, it's just less, I don't know. There's just a less of a machine.
Yeah, absolutely. Oh, and I forgot about one of the biggest influences from They Live, or that They Live has given to other people, which is the artist Shepard Fairey with all the Obey clothing that is taken directly from They Live. Yeah. So it started its own like hipster skateboard culture as well too, with all the subliminal messaging signs from They Live.
And it's pro wrestling. It's Andre the Giant.
Oh yeah,
face and Obey. But again, that goes back to the book too, or it goes back to the short story, which had all of those ideas in it too.
Yeah,
no one does it alone. You take a good idea and you really can expound upon it.
Absolutely. So is there anything else that you want to say about They Live, or you think that we have it covered?
Yeah, I mean, I think that They Live is one of the best documentaries ever made.
Yeah. You clearly see it like that. Yeah.
Well, I mean, so you're like, when Piper's going into like LA, it's like you look at downtown LA and it's like swaths of homeless camps. You could screenshot that and just be like, this is the 5 o'clock news.
Yeah, we were talking about that yesterday. Although look at like what Venice has turned into now. It's like it's nothing but at least the last I've seen videos from it. It's wall to wall like tent city everywhere. Yeah, it's like shanty towns, tent city. yeah. ever. It's done nothing but so. They Live was 1988, and now it's the homelessness population has tripled easily.
I think we can safely say that They Live has invented homelessness.
yeah.
It made it cool, made it chic.
Yeah. Well, he was a very like non-dirty looking homeless guy. That's for sure. He was
He just started.
Well, he did I think he did go in and get a shower like towards the beginning. But yeah, it didn't look like he had been unbathed or unshowered for. He wasn't like Big Lebowski style. He was
no.
Yeah.
You feel like he was riding even like a hobo.
You could tell that in real life he had been through that for sure. And that's what matters right there. But
yeah, kind of like a Rambo type character a little
bit. Yeah, very like that drifter kind of character. It's funny that they didn't give him a name except for Nada that they call him.
That's the character from the book too. The
short okay, yeah.
Nada. But it's like the man with no, but it fits with
like the, yeah, I was going to say, yeah, you're reading my mind, like the man with no name sort of thing. And that fits the whole Western thing. John Carpenter does a lot of his stuff too. Yeah. Well, yeah. Not. So, yeah. So, so agreed. This movie could be viewed almost as just like a straight up documentary. And especially with except for like actually having the government admit and show us the footage of aliens and seeing them among us, everything else with like all like the conspiracy theories and the paranoia and like what's happening to people with the loss of individual freedoms and their surveillance and all that.
Yeah
fairly accurate.
Yeah, it is absolutely insane. You know, it's funny too. The movie, so again, so it's like it really to get back to the sunglasses. Mm-hmm. You know, where it's like there's kind of an allegory there too, where it's like, you know, if the sunglasses are what, you know, it's basically a tool like the internet to wake you up, or it's just a tool. You put those on, you get to see the world as it is. But if you wear them too long, you get a headache. That's true. So think about that as to like, you know, we've all spent, well, me. have spent more than an afternoon going chasing down rabbit holes, and you're like, show it, kid. It's midnight. I've got to stop. It's kind of a warning too, where it's like, you can't, you know, it's like have a healthy balance. I think a life balance in some ways is like, I think maybe a point they're trying to make there.
Yeah. Yeah, absolutely. Yeah, it is. Yeah. Like social media, you can, well, when you go down the rabbit holes too, you can dig into it, and when you're trying to uncover the truth, but it does hurt your head. Yeah, if you're staring at that screen for too long, it does hurt you. That's interesting, but yeah, totally true.
Well, that's the method that wakes you up, right? So it's like, okay, because at the end of the day, you can howl at the moon. Essentially, that's all it is. There's no like, what did all 9/11, you know, the people that were into like 9/11 truth or any of that, at the end of the day, you know, you have people that have just dedicated their lives and have gone absolutely crazy. But at the end, like, but what does it get you? You know,
yeah.
Flat Earth. Okay, so here's flat Earth. Oh, the Earth is flat. No, we just that and the other. We can't fly more than 5 miles up. Rockets bend off the, you know, the curve of the whatever the firmament. Yeah, but you ain't even if that's true, you're not leaving. No one's going to Mars. It ain't gonna be you, me, or anybody listening to this podcast or anybody else. No one's going anywhere. This is your home. This is where you're at. So does it matter if it's flat or curved or whatever? It's hilarious that people get so like invested in it. It doesn't matter. You're not gonna live on the moon.
Yeah. Yeah. Except for Jared Leto, because he's 30 seconds to Mars. So he's the only one though.
Exactly. Let me see. I think I have one more thought.
Okay.
Two things, but we'll get to it. So again, you know, not I love They Live. I really love it. And like you get positives and negatives with low budget, you know, cinema. The ending is like, oh man. It's just not what you'd hoped for, in my opinion. I mean, it's like kind of anticlimactic. It's almost like they kind of ran out of time. They're just like, okay, this happens and you kill him and then you're going to flip off the helicopter and we're like out.
Yeah. Aliens exposed and movie ends. Yeah. Yeah. Well, it's like leaving it open for like an episode two. It's like a TV series. That's like a cliffhanger for episode two or something. Yeah.
Well, it's just like you live in this like complete Matrix world. Mm-hmm. You put the glasses on and it's like, oh, babe, this, that, and the other. And you knock out one TV satellite and it's right. Over.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah.
What the fuck?
Yeah. 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 It ends. Yeah. It ends very abruptly. Well, it's almost like it ends sort of like where Act Three should start, kind of, when they expose the aliens.
Yeah. Well, now what? It's just like, I love the movie, but the more you look at it, the more it, like, for instance, the aliens themselves, are they part of this system? Or are they like overlords? Are they just like working their asses off? Like there's a scene where one of the, you know, how that blonde has sex with the dude, the movie. It's like, I don't think it was thought out, to be absolutely honest. I just think it was just is what it is.
Yeah. The only thing they really explained was the aliens were giving people money to go along with the aliens plan, but they didn't describe like how that was happening
they're terraforming the planet through global warming, which is another conspiracy too. And but are the aliens like part, are they more enslaved? Because it's just like, you like, I don't know, they're just situations where it's like, it's just when you pull the glasses on, there's another deeper level that happens. It's like you've got your movie that you're telling, and then all of a sudden it's like the subconscious level. So it's like the business guy at the newspaper stand. Does he see too?
Right.
Because he's reading a newspaper that says obey, and that doesn't take much to read that. Yeah. It's like, what's he holding the newspaper for? Is that, it looks like a prop for everyone else. It just was, you just can't, I don't know. Like I said, it brings up more questions than I think it knows the answers to.
Yeah. Yeah. So don't look under the surface in more ways than one, because your whole worldview may be thrown off and spiral you into chaos, or you might expose some flaws of one of your favorite low budget movies.
Yeah. Well, I just don't know.
But we still love it. But no, I absolutely understand what you're saying. Cause like all the stuff that you're talking about when you go over and watch movies repeatedly is when you start to uncover some of that. Yeah. Like peeling off the onion, like conspiracy theory layers is very similar to that. Yeah.
I'm like, well, like, are the aliens, I mean, are they, because they at no point, they only fire back once they're fired at. Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Like, you know what I mean? Yeah. The Holly chick, the whatever, shoots the dude in the back of the head. Mm-hmm. That was like out of nowhere. But like, yeah, are they also enslaved? Are they part of the system? Are they controlling the system? They just don't really, there needs to be a sequel.
Yeah, I think there's, and I do also think that like with minimalism too, there are great things about not telling too much, right? But then there are also not two great things about not telling too much, because you gotta flesh out. So I think what we're saying is basically we wanted to see it fleshed out a little bit more, because the ideas were so awesome in it and so kind of, and had so much range to be explored. We didn't really get any of that. We just sort of scratched the surface of it.
And were these ideas thought out on a deeper level? Not that they needed to be explored. They needed to be argued out and like ironed out. You know, like, I mean, there are just some things that, just like I said, it works on a surface level. And then the more you start digging in at it, it's like the movie is full of contradictions to itself. It certainly is successful in just simply the fact that people are still talking about it to this day. It's quite a movie. And it was just interesting to revisit it and like critical eye. I was like, that's what you get for $5 million.
Yeah.
You don't get everything ironed out. Yeah. Thank God. You know, last thing we need is another fucking Star Wars movie.
well, last thing we need is another Star Wars movie from Disney. Great.
Yeah. Anyway, glad it was fun.
Yeah. Thank you so much. Had a great time talking to you, Aaron. And thank you for coming back and talking about the Halloween classic and one of our all-time favorites, They Live. And for everyone listening, hope you have a great Halloween. Check out this Carpenter classic if you have not seen it yet. I watched it three more times just because it's so much fun. And RIP to the great Rowdy Roddy Piper.
And
may you be beating the living S out of someone in the afterlife right now and having a great time doing it.
Beware of women with whatever eye color that is that she had, because they cannot be trusted.
Yeah, you know, I thought they were green, but they're like this really like weird, kind of like psychedelic blue.
Those are her real eyes too.
Yeah, but it's definitely, she has like an otherworldly sort of appearance to her. Yeah, absolutely. Yeah, beware of that. The crazy eyes. I would say just say the crazy eyes in general. That's a good advice to beware of. And that is it for this episode of the Dead Harvey Podcast. And until next time, stick to the roads. Stay away from the moors.